Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Coming up on the programme today, in a moment, myself and Dave will discuss some of the current business headlines from the local and national papers.
In the business of this week, it's the business of Brexit. I was recently at a Brexit summit in the Convention Centre and I have an update on what was talked about there. And then Fergal O'Brien from the NSAI, the National Standards Authority of Ireland, will chat to Declan and myself about how Brexit is likely to impact on standards and certifications and what business can do to mitigate the risk.
David Bell from the HR department will be along after that for his regular look at HR issues this week. David's going to chat to me about family-friendly workplaces. Finally then, the P60 and the P45 will become a thing of the past when all PAYE dealings go real-time from January. Accountant Stephen Egan will be here with us to discuss the implications of PAYE modernisation for employers. And he'd be along before the end of the programme. Now, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories this evening, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air. The number is 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get us on Twitter at any time at @nearby_business. #localbiz.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
So Dave, our usual first look at what's in the papers at the moment, business-wise. And I see that Uniplumo are in the festive spirit after securing a major contract.
Yeah, a couple of stories from the Sunday Business Post of last week. Uniplumo will supply 120 festive plants to the Musgrave Group. And the North Dublin plant grower Uniplumo will see staff numbers rise more than 60 over the Christmas period on foot of a contract to supply 120,000 poinsettias to SuperValu and Centra stores nationwide during the festive season. The Swords Company will grow poinsettias in order to order for both Musgrave brands, building up on existing business relationships stretching back 22 years. The plants will be available in all 669 SuperValu and Centra stores in a number of formats priced between €3 and €13. And a new glitter poinsettia will be introduced retailing at a 5 You might be interested in that, Declan. We are proud to source all of our poinsettias locally from Uniplumo, said Eamon Howell, Trading Director of SuperValu and Centra.
It's the plant that's most associated with Christmas, that's called poinsettia, all sorts of things. But I think you did the pronunciation
Thank you very much. Well, I know in the Botanic Gardens there is there's beautiful wings on the grand glasshouse there, the great glasshouse. And one of the wings to the left was originally the poinsettia house. And that was apparently in the past, in the 70s. And this is what I was told when I went in there one day by one of the local gardening people. They said that all the government ministers were given a plant, a present from there every year as a gift from the National Botanic Gardens. Beautiful. This time of the year, you'll see them coming up in a gorgeous environment. Great place to visit for free as well.
It is a lovely colour into the dark evenings. And you're a font of information, Dave, too. A leprechaun game inventor has struck gold.
Yes, this is a great story. The inventor of My Buddy Max Buddy, a new leprechaun-themed children's game combining a book and a toy, has signed up more than 50 stockists in Ireland, including Dublin retailer Arnott's. Owen Heverin has also agreed a deal to supply Toy Masters outlets in Ireland, as well as Knock Airport in County Mayo. He is in talks with Carol's Irish Gifts also. The time is right for someone to challenge the American Elf on the Shelf, said Heverin. Elf on the Shelf has sold over 11 million units worldwide, and I believe My Buddy Max Buddy could match or even surpass these figures. Arnott's have ordered more units from us this year than they ordered from the Elf on the Shelf last year, and My Buddy Max Buddy combines a plush toy, which is a leprechaun, with a children's book featuring a character described by Heverin as a magical leprechaun who comes from magic land. Now, if he wasn't there and saying this in the paper and someone come up to you and said that in the street, you wouldn't know what to think. The book is designed to encourage and nurture children's imagination by bringing a lead character to life with a little bit of help from the parents, he said. Max Buddy arrives in your house with a pot of gold and a 7 gold coins. You mind his pot of gold and he minds the 7 gold coins in magic land. When you are good, he magically pops a gold coin into your pot. When you collect all 7 coins, you get to make a wish. Everyone developed Max Buddy concept after first establishing Tell My Storybook in October 2015 to produce personalised storybooks for children. Everyone appeared on the RTE television series Dragon's Den in 2016, securing 40,000 from Barry O'Sullivan. And Max Buddy, Max Buddy is available to buy online and it costs $29.95.
My Buddy, Max Buddy. I had to check the calendar there to make sure it wasn't the 1st of April.
Yeah.
But you say it's in the Journal of the Sunday Business Post, and perhaps it'll end up on the Late Late Toy Show as well.
I'd say it's a real candidate for that, and a great idea, and he's going to take on the Americans there. And like leprechauns, it's probably one of the national assets that we really haven't tapped into
exploited
yet.
Exploited enough.
Yes,
indeed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Business of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
In the business of this week, it's the business of Brexit. I was recently at a Brexit summit in the Convention Centre and I have an update on what was talked about there.
Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. Show you something to make you change your mind.
You know, I think there has been some progress made in the last couple of days between the negotiators. But as I mentioned earlier, the Irish government's position, which is the same as the European Union's position, stands. We know the space in which a deal can happen, and I just hope the UK is able to work its way into that space. There's always different suggestions floating around. I know one of the suggestions floating around now is that perhaps the transition period could be longer than 2 years. I think we have to listen to any proposal like that. I've always thought it would be very hard to negotiate a new treaty between the EU and the UK, setting out our new relationship in less than 2 years, and also get it ratified by 27 parliaments. So I think we have to listen to any suggestions that perhaps the transition period or the implementation phase could be longer. But that certainly cannot be a substitute for a protocol on Ireland, the backstop, which assures us that no matter what happens, there won't be a hard border on our island. And it certainly couldn't be a substitute for that. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I don't think the United Kingdom will crash out. But of course, the prospect of Britain crashing out does frighten people. And particularly, it's impactful in Northern Ireland, because if you're a nationalist in Northern Ireland, you fear the potential of a return as an unintended consequence of Brexit, of a hard border on the island of Ireland. That, and I think many unionists fear that too, by the way, it's not just nationalists. The memories of border infrastructure on the island of Ireland are very bad memories, very tragic memories, in some cases very violent memories. And the idea that on 300 road crossings between Ireland and Northern Ireland, on a 300 kilometre border, that we would attempt Britain and Ireland to try to reimpose border infrastructure and the security infrastructure that would be required around that infrastructure, to me is just something that we cannot accept. And so we need to find a way to avoid that.
I don't think anybody understands the seriousness of Brexit. Britain is going through Armageddon. It's a doomsday scenario. We have a situation where it has a prime minister that was meeting her cabinet or her group of 22 or 40, the 1922 committee today. Her future is on the chopping block. They were saying she's going to turn up at the meeting, but she'd come along with a noose. She's in the killing zone. She's a dead woman walking. They're the issues that are there. And depending on the media you listen to, if you listen to the Irish media, you get the Irish slant put out by the Irish government. If you listen to the British, they're fed information. And the facts are, for us all in business or trying to get involved in business, there's a huge depth between the politician and the business person. And we're really facing that issue really, really hard. Ireland can do only so much. A number of the companies that want to come to Ireland, the big issue is accommodation. There is no accommodation for people. One of our clients is Animation Ireland. One of them is Brand Bag in Smithfield. They're doing great work. They're world class. They're at the cutting edge, but they can't employ anybody. They can't get any more people on. So we're looking at a situation where there's complete meltdown. And we will have a situation where the planes won't fly. We will have a situation where the port of Calais will be closed. Motorways will be sealed to have car parks, giant car parks, for juggernauts and transport. Medicines and foods are going to be imported into the UK. And as soon as somebody realises that, okay,
so good news.
That's the good news, yeah. But that's, we all need to have a reality check in terms of the impact that's going to have on each and every one of us. And we have the campaigns, we hear these radio ads on a regular basis, are you Brexit ready? Nobody is Brexit ready because they don't know what this situation is going to be. So it's critically important in terms of somebody coming to grips with it. Whether another referendum in the UK in terms of the people's vote, will that work? My business associate Alistair Campbell is campaigning for that at the moment. They had a big march last weekend, but the government say, well, that's only X amount of people. If there was a referendum tomorrow, that's not going to carry the vote. So the situation is very bleak, it's very serious, and I didn't even bring up the Irish border in terms of where that is. And then we have the backstop within the backstop. So if somebody could tell us really where we're going, as people in business, we're facing a bleak future. One issue that happened in the last 24 hours, 13 Nobel scientists in the UK have come out and have said the impact Brexit will have in terms of intellectual properties, sharing information, sharing data. The UK Border Force had the same situation, getting back into cyber. The situation is, will they be able to share information? It's the European arrest warrant. That also will come into question as to how that's going to work in terms of extraditing people from the UK or from Europe in terms of various cases that are coming in. Mm-hmm. So there's a myriad of issues that we still haven't explored. Meanwhile, there's point scoring on in Brussels between the UK government and some EU peers. So issues like that need to be taken on board.
So, David, my name is Jonathan McMillan. I am in charge of our Brexit Preparedness Unit at Enterprise Ireland. We're delighted to be part of the event this morning, very excited about it. In Enterprise Ireland, I suppose the most common question we get asked by Irish companies is, what can we be doing with so much uncertainty still around the whole Brexit scenario? Is there anything that we can be doing? Well, we've recently done a survey of our over 2,400 of our clients, and 85% of them now say they are taking Brexit preparedness actions.
And what sort of actions would these be generally?
So in the early days, if we look back to June 2016, whenever the referendum happened, by far the number one thing that we were being asked was around hedging and managing currency risk. Because the currency, if you remember back then, well, it swung, I think, by 8% in a few hours. Mm-hmm. But as we've moved forward through the process, the number one area that we're being asked about now is customs.
Yes.
You have to remember that customs is something that most of our companies, both importers and exporters, haven't had to do for, 20 or 30 years?
No, so in the event of a duty being imposed and delays of VAT at point of entry, has there any provision been made for that?
No, so customs we have to be careful on. So customs is the one area we're advising our companies to really look at what it is they do. So is it a product or a service? What sector they're operating in? And who it is that they're either selling to or buying from, specifically in the UK. So that's the starting point. We run advisory clinics around the country. They're all on our website, prepareforbrexit.ie. And we would recommend that companies come along. They're open to all companies. Come along and meet the experts that we have, specifically in customs. The second thing I would just say in the customs piece is, we are just about, if you go into prepareforbrexit.ie, we're about to come out with a online training tool, mm-hmm. which is again available to all companies, specifically at customs, and what you should be doing either as an exporter or an importer, talking you through the main steps and those main things that you should be looking at.
Very good. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm John Madigan from the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland, the SBCI, and we were set up 4 years ago by the Department of Finance to assist SMEs with bringing down the price of borrowing for SMEs and also to help them with access to finance for SMEs. Latest scheme we have in the market is the Brexit Loan Scheme, 300 million scheme, interest rate 4%, loans from 25,000 to 1.5 million. Up to half a million is unsecured, which is a major change in the Irish market in terms of lending to SMEs. And the eligibility piece on the Brexit loan scheme is done through the SBCI. So all we'd ask Brexit impacted companies to do is to log on to the SBCI website, complete the eligibility form. We will issue you with an eligibility number, which you can then take to any one or all three of the banks that are participating in this particular scheme.
Okay, and just you mentioned there about security and
yes.
the thing. So previously people would have to have told them what they had for their breakfast.
Yes.
How easier is this? How much easier is this?
Well, because it's carrying an 80% government guarantee in, all right, effectively 20% of that loan is unsecured. And we have agreed as part of the scheme that up to $500,000 under this scheme cannot have any other security attaching to it.
Okay, and is this program have a time scale? Is it limited?
Yes,
for a period?
It's open until March 2020.
Yes.
And basically that $300 million will be available up until then.
And the time payback period then?
Is 3 years.
It's
a working capital scheme, and it's designed to help businesses stock up in the event that there are problems with their supply chain in Brexit, as an example. But we're going to follow this with a long-term investment scheme, which will be real 7 to 10 year money, which will be built along the same basis as the Brexit loan scheme, and that will become available hopefully early in 2019.
Okay, how do we avail of this? Have you a website?
Yes, sbci.gov.ie, and we also have a free phone number. So if you click in to the SBCI website, it'll take you straight to the Brexit loan scheme, and it'll give you the number as well.
John Madigan, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Hopefully it won't be the last train to London. And just recently, a large-scale survey of the UK population has found that the majority of British people think that Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage and Jeremy Corbyn would have handled the Brexit negotiations, wait for it, worse than Prime Minister Theresa May. So they think she is doing a pretty good job for them out there at the moment. Don't know what has happened in the last hour, and it's changing by the hour as it happens, as we know. Now, the NSAI is the official standards body in Ireland. They operate under the National Standards Authority of Ireland Act 1996 and are accountable to the Minister for Business, Enterprise and Innovation. Now, Fergal O'Brien joins me from the NSAI, Standards Authority of Ireland, to chat through how Brexit is likely to impact on the standards and certification and what businesses can do to mitigate the risk. Good evening, Fergal, and you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks much, David. I'm glad to be on board and to talk to you.
Yeah, I know you're only back from business in Doha, so I hope we're not keeping you awake when you're trying to go back to sleep after a long journey like that. But thank you very much for joining us. Anyway, we're familiar with the standards which cover products and services. We regularly hear of ISO and CE markings for services and products. Likelihood of a bad Brexit. What's kind of in store for us in terms of standards?
Well, I suppose the big change will be in that latter part, the CE marking and product conformity. We think that the standards themselves, or the technical standards themselves, won't be majorly affected in any way. Certainly the ISO standards, the ISO for quality, ISO 9000, and other similar ISO standards, which are worldwide standards, won't be affected at all by Brexit, because the UK, just like Japan or America or Russia, will comply with the requirements at ISO level. So the management standards themselves, the technical documents, will stay the same. The technical standards for products which govern and support CE marking in the medium term will not change, we believe. Certainly the British themselves have been very forceful in saying that they are going to continue to obey all the rules from the European standards bodies, which they may or may not be allowed to stay in. That's still in play. But either way, the British have said they're going to stay faithful and they're not going to start putting in new rules or lessening rules. That's their position at the moment, but that, of course, could change. I suppose the big change, though, David, will be that how the standards are used, and that's the certification to the standards. So currently, Britain is part of the European Union, and we have a single market of goods, capital, labour and services. So these can serve freely throughout the European Union, by and large, with some little hiccups here and there. But by and large, that works. Now, once Britain leaves, and that could be on the 29th of March of next year, or a later date, if by agreement, Britain will become a third country. So, for instance, if we took CE marking, and CE marking works in two directions. So at the moment, Irish manufacturers CE mark their product, put it on the market here in Europe, and that's sold off to the UK or to France or Germany or our own market here in Ireland, and that's fine. And to, in many situations, to be allowed to put the mark on the CE mark on the product, they need a notified body to support them. So we in NSI are a notified body, but we're not the only notified body. There are 7 in Ireland. We're one of that group. There's 174 in the UK. Now, many Irish companies use the UK notified bodies for very specialised work. All the UK notified bodies will cease to exist on Brexit Day.
Would they include organisations like BISRAM, British Standard?
Yes, BSI as a notified body will cease to be a notified body unless it moves out of the UK jurisdiction and moves to a European country. So it could come to Ireland, or it could go to the Netherlands, or it could go to France. And it's not simply, you know, renting office accommodation and moving your staff. You have to be recognised in that country and notified by that country. So this is like a maybe a 6 month minimum to more like a year process.
Did I hear something about that, that the British standards are setting up in Holland? Did I hear in Amsterdam? Did I hear that recently?
I believe so. I believe they're setting up in Amsterdam. But again, it's not a case of just renting some accommodation and moving some chairs and desks in. It's a very technical process to become a notified body. And of the 174 UK notified bodies, we believe only a small number are in the process or have even started the process of moving. And this is with now about 4.5 months to go.
Yeah.
So we would say to Irish companies who are using British notified bodies, you need to start talking to your notified body, see what they're doing, and start looking at alternatives. And come and talk to NSI and we'll try and get you alternatives elsewhere in Europe if none of the Irish number can do it. So that's... a big issue, but perhaps even a much bigger issue, and something that's really gone under the radar to some extent, is that Ireland is a big purchaser of British goods.
Mm-hmm.
So we might be buying the finished good, or we might be buying components. So someone making a machine might buy pumps, might buy pressure vessels, might buy couplings off the British market, off British suppliers, and you simply drive your van over, you load it up, and you drive it back. There's no problem. Now, once the British leave the European Union, those products are now being brought into Europe by the Irish manufacturer or wholesaler, and they have whole new duties that they never thought of before as either an authorised representative or an importer or a distributor.
Yeah, and where does the responsibility lie? That's the question I have in front of me here. Where does the responsibility lie for those importers? Yeah.
Well, the responsibility lies with the authorised representative or the importer. So if I'm buying something from the UK at the moment, I send my van over or I get someone to collect it, and it comes in here. At the moment, the British manufacturer is responsible legally in Europe because they're in Europe. But once they're outside Europe, it's right in relation to the compliance for CE marking, I, as the importer and the authorised representative, effectively take on that responsibility. So because remember, if someone's outside the jurisdiction, they can't be touched legally. So if something goes wrong or a product fails, the judicial system will come after the person within the jurisdiction of Europe, the new Europe 27. And that could be your ID importer, who we didn't realise we had those responsibilities and don't have them today, but could well have them come the 30th of April of next year.
Okay, just on that, on that point, just to, before we leave that point, just if somebody do they have to submit then an item of that category or caliber for testing, or how would certification be gained then for coming into?
There's nothing. The good news, I suppose, is nothing new in this. And this is how we do business, say, with China, for instance. So if you're bringing product in from China, you make sure that the factory in China is fully certified and is manufacturing these products in accordance with the agreed European standard, and that factory has been audited by a notified body from Europe. So those rules will now apply, but it's the legal responsibility of the first importer into the European Union, who now could be an Irish distributor who never thought he had or she had those duties before. And that's a big change, as I say.
Yeah, I regularly see in my business, very similar to what you just mentioned there, a very similar kind of business category, that people will be looking for business certification or business testing on a particular item, you know, which just is something that they see regularly. Consulting engineers may need something to be tested to a particular... Now, it's comfort really in a lot of cases, because quite a lot of the time the products are well tested by Bureau Veritas and TÜV in Europe, and which are very high standards in Germany and Denmark and other countries like that. And they would have the CE in certain cases is a past because of the standardisation of these things or the testing that's carried out with products like that. So
absolutely. The whole idea of the CE marking, when it was, if we go back 20 years or more, standards were used to some extent as barriers to trade. So it flipped on its head with the new approach when it came in, and standards, a common single European standard certified locally to these common set of rules, meant that once the product had its CE mark, it basically had its own passport, and it should be able to move freely among the current EU 28. And that has actually worked very well and continues to work to this day. Unfortunately, and whether we like it or not, the world will be a poorer place as a result of Brexit.
Absolutely,
whether we have a good agreement or a poor agreement.
Yeah.
We're going backwards in time.
Yeah.
And people, you know, we had got rid of needless duplicate and quadruple certification and testing.
Mm.
We had single testing, single test report, single certificate, single CE marking, the product could then, as I said, move freely. And because of Brexit, unfortunately, the reality is we're going backwards. And our job now is to try and manage that in as economic and efficient way as possible. And by doing that, we want to make sure that manufacturers, distributors, importers, users understand the rules that will apply come Brexit Day.
Yeah, I just say that, just one thing on that. I do remember that there was talk of the British government cutting and pasting the European standards into their actual standards. And business being business, businesses who want to do business in Ireland and other parts of the EU will make sure that they have a certified house to come along and look at their products. I'm pretty sure that's going to happen, if not before, but fairly quickly after.
Yes, well, at the high level legislative procedure, the directives themselves, once Britain left the European Union, then the directives like the machinery directive or the toys directive to make sure that children's toys are safe wouldn't be legal in the UK. So the part of their legal framework is they've wrapped all existing 40 years of EU law into British national law on one particular date. So the high-level directives which set out the essential safety requirements for, as I said, children's toys or machinery or pressure vessels or construction products or medical devices will be there. But the issue is who certifies them. And at the moment, the UK are a big player in this area, as you've just said, and you're absolutely right. Very, very big player. And many people in Ireland rely on UK bodies to do this work for them. But regrettably, one of the downsides of the British people voting for Brexit will be that they're unwinding that process, that we're going backwards, we're putting the ship into reverse. And that means that things that we took for granted, that was ease of trade, will not apply anymore. And one of those real hard crunches are the fact that the 174 British notified bodies will cease to exist, either on 29th of March of next year or whatever date. If there is agreement. So I suppose worst case scenario is 29th of March, best case scenario it's the last day of 2020, which itself is a long way, because getting recertified and getting your products retested and getting your hands on a new notified body who's competent to do your work, it's not a simple process. And at the moment, we help organisations do that. We ourselves in NSCI can't provide the services. We try and get people the services out in the UK, which will no longer be available to us, or in Europe. And the moving to Europe isn't that simple, because while the salesman in Europe or saleswoman in Europe might speak English, the auditor might not have good English, the forms will be in French or German or Spanish. So we will have a more complex and difficult conformity environment in the future.
Listen, thank you very much for coming on the programme. Head of Business Excellence Certification at the National Standards Authority of Ireland, Fergal O'Byrne. We'll speak to you probably before the dreaded date again if we can. Thank you for coming on Nearby Business.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, it's a really interesting subject, isn't it? I mean, there's so many elements of legislation, so many elements of life and business life that are going to be affected by Brexit. It's just incredible.
Absolutely. And can I just quote you from the Iron Lady? This is something which was on LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago. And she said, just think for a moment what a prospect that is. This is a single market without barriers, visible or invisible, giving you direct and unhindered access to the purchasing power of over 300 million of the world's wealthiest and most prosperous people. Bigger than Japan, bigger than the United States, on your doorsteps, and with the Channel Tunnel to give you direct access to it. It's not a dream, it's not a vision, it's not some bureaucrat's plan, it's for real. And Margaret Thatcher said that, and that was about the EU.
Yeah.
So. We're going backwards, all right.
How things change. Okay, coming up in the second part of the programme, another HR question answered by David Bell from the HR department. Accountant Stephen Egan will be here on PAYE modernisation. All of that to come in the second part of Nearby Business. Don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories today, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air to 087-69-44500. That's 087-69-44500. Or you can get us anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
David Bell from the HR department is here now for his regular look at HR issues. And David, it's a fairly topical subject over the last little while. So we're going to chat about managing people through holidays and balancing the needs of family versus the needs of the workplace, and how family-friendly workplaces maybe can help with that.
Evening, Declan. Yeah, as you say, a topic topical at the moment in terms of people taking holidays and the pressures that they might have at taking them at certain times of the year. So I think it is a challenge, particularly for smaller businesses, to try and, as you say, balance trying to acknowledge people have those with children have a family life, and balancing that against the needs of perhaps people who don't have children and might feel some resentment if there's a favouritism or a perceived favouritism towards those people. So I think that is a big challenge for businesses.
Yeah, indeed it is. And it's as you say, it's that balancing act that you have to try and do. We're just finished midterm break, which I'm sure put a lot of people under pressure. And also the Christmas is coming as well, as somebody else said, during the week. And, you know, how to manage that. So what advice have you got for employers and how to sort of maximise their position here and try and obviously, businesses are obviously focused on keeping the business alive and on the road, but if you don't keep the worker happy either, they'll move on to something else, particularly in the market we have now for employees.
Yeah, I think as well, I suppose, as you say, things have moved along, maybe annual leave and holidays. I mean, it isn't that long ago when for example, builders shut down for the first 2 weeks of August. So, I mean, that's sort of in an extreme way. There's no option there. Everyone took holidays at the same time because the business, pretty much all sites and everyone related to that industry, just took the first 2 weeks of August off. And in a way, it was quite simple. Everyone knew it was coming. There was no discrimination between anyone. They took their holidays then. Obviously, that even itself has moved on, and most businesses don't have. Well, there are obviously traditional hotspots, as you say, sort of Christmas, maybe around bank holidays, public holidays, and then in the summer, there's obviously weeks that people go away. It is trying to sort of just treat it like a holiday that's going to be a problem for people. It is trying to acknowledge that there are some people who, on the one hand, will perhaps feel guilty trying to put their holidays in when they know other people might want to take them, be it, as we say, if you link it to a school holiday where the people have children, versus the people who maybe don't have kids or who have kids and also want to take holidays, and trying to make sure that there's enough people around, you have enough staff around for the business to run effectively. Because ultimately that is, to some extent, even under the legislation, it recognises that the employer, is entitled to have some say when that annual leave is taken to ensure the effective running of the business. But as I said, I think that is, people are much more aware, employers are much more aware perhaps of the nuances and the flexibility required in dealing with these requests. And I think, it was apart from the very odd lastminute.com, someone arrives in and says, I've just got a great deal for my week and wherever can I go? Most employers will be generous if they can.
Yeah.
But in the vast majority of places, people are now putting much more structured requests for holidays going in, making sure that they have people. And I think communication has played a big part in that, in terms of people understanding the needs of other people in the business and maybe having a bit of sympathy and a bit more understanding than it just being seen as someone taking all the time. So I think that's very important, if a culture can be created whereby people are aware there are different pressures at different times of the year, and if there's a compromise that can be reached, that's really what you're trying to strive for.
And would it be that perhaps in a smaller or an SME size company, that maybe you would sit down with the staff and maybe there's going to be people there with different requirements, and I'm sure there'll be, as you say, there'll be people with children and people who don't have children, and maybe work out have a chat about that and work out something that suits everybody. Is that appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, just from a personal perspective, I worked when I started off my career, I worked in a solicitor's office, and they closed at Christmas. So everyone working there had those holidays off. You were closed for probably a week or 10 days around the Christmas. So all that time I was used to being off. And that was something that, it was the way I thought the way the world worked. my naivety.
Until you set up your own business, David.
Well, absolutely. Then you never get any Declan. But I was working then in other companies, and I remember it did come to Christmas, and it was just a presumption of mine that I was going to get the week around Christmas off for the 10 days. But I was very lucky that I had a colleague, and he said to me, look, I'm happy to come in for a few days over the Christmas and you can, you know, so that was a compromise that we reached ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
But of course, if he hadn't offered that, I probably would have had to. And I think, you know, that happens in a lot of businesses where if it's open, you know, generally people either do year on, year off, or they might do, you know, the 2 days between Stephen's Day and New Year's, and then some people do the time after. So there's definitely has to be some compromise. And if someone has a serious request, maybe wants to go overseas, if there's someone not living, you know, not from Ireland, wants to go home for an extended period of time, most people, if they know about it and are given a bit of notice, you know, will accommodate others. I think it's just when it's sprung on them or it's seen as an entitlement that someone takes without knowing the full story. I think that's part of the problem. And I certainly have had stories, and I know, you know, personally, where situations where someone has said, look, you know, my kids are grown up, not me, but people have said, you know, my kids are grown up, I'm happy to come in over a holiday period on the basis that there are people here with younger families, and I think it's important. So that's someone stepping up to do that.
Yeah, so it's and a bit of give and take, a little bit of talking about it and trying to come to some agreement on it, I suppose.
Yeah, and then other things you can do. I mean, again, a lot of companies, you know, you have to take your holidays within your annual leave year, which is either, you know, under the statute, it's April to March, but a lot of companies operate in January to December. So sometimes when it's coming towards the end of the year, people are under pressure if they have to take holidays, and that can cause not only the business a problem, but if it's use it or lose it, you know, on the one hand, the company is saying you have to take your holidays, on the other hand, they're saying, well, we need staff to run the operation. But if there's a number of people haven't taken holidays, and they can't take them before the end of the year, you know, companies should start looking at some capacity to carry over, obviously not all of your annual leave, because they should be taking that anyway under the health and safety side of things. But if there were 2 or 3 days left over, that maybe they should consider they could take them at the start of the new calendar year, you know, January or February. And sometimes we would often have clients who might say, well, you can carry over a maximum of 3 days or 4 days, but you have to take them within the first 3 months of the new calendar year. So yeah, it doesn't build up
for too long,
year on year. Yeah. But, you know, things like that can help as well. So if someone says, well, look, I'm prepared to come in for a few days of a school holiday, if we're talking about matching it to school holidays, but I will get an extra, I'll be allowed to take holidays, you know, in the new year if it's Christmas or at another time that you know, or they make, or it can, as I said, they can roster it. They can say, well, the midterm break in spring, I'll work that, and you work the midterm break in October, because everyone knows they're coming up. I mean, they're in the calendar.
Yeah. So Christmas comes at the same time every year. Yeah, it shouldn't be a surprise.
And I think, you know, you see it around holidays, as we all know, if you try and book a holiday around the school holidays.
Yeah.
I think in the UK, I don't know whether it's just the businesses that I work with, but a lot of people seem to take off midterm breaks. I don't know if you've experienced that yourself, but, you know, if you have any connection or dealings with UK-based companies, a lot of people with kids take off the midterm breaks. It's sort of
just the way they do things, yeah. I agree with you. Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, you often hear stories and people get into trouble over there by taking kids out of school outside of that. But they all do seem to, you know, if you try and book or go away on a holiday, if people are lucky enough to go skiing or you go to the sun, around the UK holidays, you'll see a huge amount of British families. They do seem to follow that pattern. Yeah. So obviously that is maybe part of the culture and part of the way they've operated things. But we may not be so close to that, but I think it's certainly happening. I think the cost of childcare and all that, if people are off school, you know, most times one of the parents is going to have to be off at some stage.
Yeah, and of course you can see it in the traffic, of course, as well, around the city roads as well, when people are off, and when schools are off. I know that you just quote from your blog, David writes a great blog on his website, hrdepartment.ie, David, I think. You finish up a blog you wrote on this recently with the sense is that superior planning and management alongside a joint attitude will ensure organisations work together with working parents and tackle the whole holiday period thing. And I think that's probably the synopsis, really, isn't it? It's a joint attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of what we talk about, Declan, you know, the common theme, I think communication, inclusivity, cooperation is the buzzwords that we use a lot. And I think this is another example where, you know, if there are issues arising purely out of the fact that people aren't having the chance to communicate or engaging with people to solve the problem. Often people are much happier if they're engaged with to solve the problem themselves rather than it being foisted on them or them feeling that they've absolutely no control over it.
Indeed, yeah. Well, David, as usual, thanks for that. A very comprehensive look at family-friendly workplaces. I suppose there's probably place for a policy to be written on it as well, I'm sure. You'd recommend that?
As always. Unfortunately, policy is another policy, but yes, I mean, annual leave and the taking of annual leave, and then you could expand on that in that sort of family flexibility, family-friendly way, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a million, David.
Okay, Declan.
Thank you. That's David Bell there from the HR department for his usual look at HR issues from the employer's point of view. In a moment now, we're going to talk to Stephen Egan, who's an accountant, and we're going to be talking to him about the implications for PAYE modernisation on local businesses. And we'll be back talking to him in just a moment.
You're listening to Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM. Every Thursday at 6 p.m, the local, national and international business news headlines with a focus on what affects us here in Northeast Dublin. Regular features on the programme will include the Business Of section, where each week a different industry or industry leader will be here to chat about what makes their business work. The latest tool and technology needed to make sure your business remains at the leading edge. HR issues will be discussed, as well as a particular focus on looking at matters from the employer's point of view. Being an entrepreneur can be a lonely pursuit, so there'll be a regular look at what supports are available for business in the local area. And a host of special features as well. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can text while the show is on the air to 087 69 44 500. Or at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business. Near FM's business programme is Nearby Business.
Welcome back to Nearby Business. Don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. And you can get us on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Okay, the P60 and P45 will become a thing of the past when all PAYE dealings go real time from January. Accountant and barrister Stephen Egan joins me now to discuss the implications for employers in more detail. Good evening, Stephen.
Good evening, Dave. Good evening.
I know you're away at the moment, and you're actually there. You're able to talk to us very quickly, and I'm delighted to have you on the programme. From the 1st of January, you'll report payroll to the revenue at the time you pay your employees. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, from the 1st of January, the PAYE system is going all online, and it's going to be in real time. So what that means is when you're now paying somebody, at the end of the week or the end of the month, you have to update the record, an obligation to automatically update the record to get an up-to-date tax-free certificate for each employee that you have. And then also, you'll be inputting how much you're paying them in that particular week or month, and then the figures, you will work the figures out on your own systems, and then they will be inputted into revenue, and return will be generated that you have to pay tax on. That's basically how it's going to work.
I noticed at
the
end.
Confusing.
It does a little bit. I'm just going to say it may be confusing to people listening ourselves, but at the end of September, it appeared that only some of 11,000 employers had provided revenue with a list of employees, and it needed the start of the new system. That means there are almost 200,000 employers in the country. 90% of the employers need to act before the end of October. Apparently, the 31st of October was the date that was laid down by the revenue for this to be signed up. And then they said if an employer fails to send a list of employees, there's a high possibility of employees being charged emergency tax in January. Is that just a deadline, or is that the cut-off point?
No, I understand. I took a bit of a look at this on the computer today, on the Google and all of it. They have extended that deadline. I don't have a specific date, but they haven't. It's not strictly the 31st of October as we speak, but they do want the stuff in as soon as possible. They want the list of employees uploaded onto their system as soon as possible. That's all I can say for the moment, you know.
Yeah, and so if you've got a couple of people or three or four people working for you, it's not going to be the end of the world. But if you've a very large organisation...
Yeah, an awful lot of employers, by the way, Dave, are small employers, but half the employers, I'm not sure the exact statistics, but maybe half the employers in the country have under 5 employees, you know.
Yeah, so that would be a relatively easy thing to do. Practically, what do you have to do? If I was to sit down and do it, say for a 2 or 3 person business tomorrow, what would I need to do?
Well, you go online to the revenue site, you know, the Ross system, and there's a facility there for uploading the list of employees. They have to be inputted. The list of employees have to be inputted into the system, and that's what you'd have to do. Now down the road, you know, that's a once-off thing as such. Down the road, as you get each additional employee, it'll be a case of going in and putting the one employee on the system. You get a tax number for that employee and check it's okay, and then they're up on the system. See, once the revenue instruct you what to do, you know, in relation to that. In other words, in the old days, people were getting tax-free certificates from revenue, but that you won't be applying for them because automatically the system's going to generate them.
Okay.
The new system.
For employees, they say the benefits if you're an employee include the ability to maximise the use of your entitlements, the availability of real-time accurate data through our online systems, and clear information about the deductions being reported to revenue on your behalf. So it's very transparent there. Like you heard horror stories years ago of a firm that may have closed down, and people went to collect their dole in certain cases, and they said, well, we haven't had anything from your company for 6 months. So this will be apparent very quickly if that's not taking place, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, or in a sense, some of that information was out there anyway, and there was a certain selling going on here, you know. But under the new system, employees, it's not compulsory, but they need to have what's called the My Account with Revenue, which is a simple account to open up, online account. There's no digital certificate or something like that. There's no. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge big deal to open it up. And then they go into My Account. They can see their up-to-date position in relation to their wages with that employer. And that up-to-date position would reflect what's gone into revenue. You know, so that would be the situation. Also, because the system is real-time, and in other words, you know, the revenue will know that you paid X 2,000 euro last week, mm-hmm. because you're obliged to tell them, mm-hmm. you know. Whereas, and that you paid them 3,000 the previous month or whatever it might be, all that information would be in real time on the revenue system once the employer has inputted, which they're obliged to do within a certain time frame. Whereas in the past, the revenue wouldn't have known that information until maybe the end of the year when the P35 went in, or perhaps the P45 had been issued during the year. Mm-hmm. So I suppose non-compliant employers will be picked up much more quickly under the new system.
Okay.
Because it's real time. The revenue will quickly see, well, the man hasn't sent in any returns for the last month or two, mm-hmm. or the last week or three, so we must get on to him. That kind of situation.
Yeah. Okay, so just to sum up then, if I'm an employer and I have, this is the first I've heard of it, what do I need to do tomorrow morning?
Well, you don't have to drop everything tomorrow morning, but a lot of employers are employing wages, agencies, and that type of thing. But what you're going to have to do is make sure your employees are uploaded to the system. That's the main thing you have to do as of now. I mean, the action is really going to start in 2019, you know.
when the system comes in the 1st of January 2019. I mean, the bottom line is that there's no change in the time in the times that things have to be sent in, your taxes paid, the returns, the return dates, and that type of thing. There's no changes in there, but the big change is that you now have to interact online with revenue, and you have to in that process of interacting with revenue, you're using up, you are getting automatically up-to-date tax-free certificate for the employee, which means that, you know, there would be less issues probably with emergency tax and all that kind of stuff that has gone on up to now, you know.
Stephen Egan, thank you very much for your knowledgeable input this evening and joining us on Nearby Business.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic, and something I suppose that we'll all have to get used to now running businesses is to do everything online.
Yeah, and he did mention the last time he was with us that this real-time invoicing was coming. So when you actually produced an invoice, that it went up on the system and the revenue knew exactly how much you were buying something for or selling it, or your costs and selling.
So you'd be paying your VAT in real-time as well.
In real-time, up to the hour. So that's something I'm sure will be very difficult for some people to take across. I won't mention any sectors.
Perhaps.
It may cause consternation among certain types.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Now, Dave, just time to look at a few more stories before we finish up. Interestingly, today IKEA has announced that they've gone cold on opening another Irish store because it's focused online instead. If you pardon the pun, IKEA has shelved plans to open more stores in Ireland for now, saying it will focus on developing its fast-growing online offering. New financial results released by the firm showed IKEA's local arm recorded €101.5 million euro of sales during the 12-month period that ended in August of 2018. During the year as well, IKEA changed its accounting structures, and the turnover now includes what they call services sales, which is the costs such as delivery, assembly and installation, which weren't in their sales last year. And interesting, even though they've put all them in, and it doesn't say how much they account for, their sales numbers have grown by 7.5%, which is substantial growth. But if you're adding in extra sales, I'm not quite sure how good it is. They came here, as we know, in 2009 when they opened over the road from us here in Ballymun. And they had previously sounded out the option of opening another store in Cork. But they've said that they were also mooted to be looking at the former Cleary's department store there in O'Connell Street as well. Because they've got a new strategy of not having just a reliance on big out-of-town boxes. They want to look at the
downtown
sort of venues as well, I suppose, to be where people are. And but they said that at the moment, the Ireland market manager, Claudia Marshall, said that there are no plans for further stores in the Republic at present. And Marshall also said that the firm was focused on developing its online shopping offering here in Ireland, and the service was only rolled out here last November despite operating it for several years in other markets. So it just shows you even IKEA is under pressure from its own online sales.
Because it's a real destination place. Last week you couldn't get down the Ballymun Road because people during the midterm break were going on family days out and you can eat there and all that kind of thing. I find it claustrophobic, to be honest with you. I don't suffer from it, but I find it hard to get in and out of. Now, it's a great store and the stuff is brilliant and it's really a great addition, but people tend to go for the day and bring the kids and all that kind of stuff with them, so it is a great spot to go. And maybe people do, I know before they were in Ireland, people used to go to Glasgow and take the ferry and all that kind of stuff, so it was a destination visit. Maybe they only need one and the rest is online.
And the rest is online, and they're also saying that they're looking to further develop their home delivery infrastructure, which is interesting as well, in Ireland, but it doesn't do the service in-house, so perhaps an opportunity for others there who'd like to take that outsourcing and run with it. I suppose finally for this evening, Dave, in the news today, we'll have to talk about it, is that Facebook are going to be in the bank centre in
Ballsbridge. The iconic building. Facebook has said it's expanding its investment in Ireland by acquiring a long-term lease on 14 acres of a new campus development in Ball's Bridge in Dublin. The premises known as Bank Centre is currently occupied by AIB. The move will substantially increase its floor space in the city, enabling it to expand its workforce by 5,000 people. Facebook has been in Ireland for nearly 10 years and currently employs 4,000 people across a number of city centre locations. The deal, which is widely expected will see it acquire the 14-acre site in South Dublin suburb, allowing it to grow its floor space by 870,000 square feet. The new campus will play host to 60 teams, that's the way they speak in that game,
absolutely,
in Ireland across engineering, legal, policy and marketing and sales. The work on a wide range of products including Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp and a thing called Oculus, never heard of that one before, will take place. That's great. A lot of construction jobs, fit out jobs going on there for suppliers as well, and they are spending a lot of money around town. They have lots of sites and they have them in really good locations, and I know it's really good to see them spending a few bob. They are the new factories there.
Yeah, great. Yeah,
that's what they are.
Great news for Dublin and great news for Ireland Inc. as well. Finally, Dave, we have an exciting and interesting business off lined up for next week.
Next week, we are joined by Michael Tyrrell, who's CEO of Dublin Aerospace, for the business of aircraft maintenance. Can't wait for that one. I'm delighted to hear about all their operations at Dublin Airport.
Look forward to that. That's it for this week for Nearby Business. Thanks to all our contributors this evening. We'll be back at the same time, 6 p.m. live next Thursday evening with Nearby Business. In the meantime, don't forget, if you have a comment on any of the stories featured today or an idea you'd like to discuss with us, you can get in touch at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz. So, from me, Declan Ralph.
And me, Dave Daly.
See you soon on the radio. Bye.
Thanks for
now.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.